Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to a reporter about new laws popping up around the country that would give workers more control over their workplace schedules.
First, 1 week ago, the state's Joint Finance Committee approved the removal of UW system tenure from state law. Yesterday and today, the UW Board of Regents, most of whom were appointed by Governor Walker, met to decide how to respond to that move.
They decided not to urge state lawmakers to reconsider the changes to tenure, and they voted to develop their own policies for tenure moving forward. Republican lawmakers have said the change will give the university more budget flexibility, while staff of the university say the change poses a threat to academic freedom.
Here with us now to talk about today's vote is Karen Herzog, higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you, Veronica.
So before we go too deep into this, I want to start by defining exactly what tenure is.
Well, tenure, it's interesting because some people perceive tenure, some people outside of academia perceive it as being a job guarantee, that no matter what, you will have a job, that someone can't touch you if they're unhappy with what you say or what your research shows. It's job security. But tenure, by definition, actually offers protection for academic freedom. That's the crucial thing for faculty when you ask them about the importance of tenure, that it's grounded in this thought that creating knowledge and expressing ideas should be free from intimidation or retaliation.
So do you think that framework you just gave us is essentially the conversation we're having right now? Advocates saying tenure is about academic freedom, and critics saying it means a job for life, which most Americans don't have. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of what's happened in recent years with the economy, so many people losing their jobs, has really put this more in the focus of should anyone be allowed to have protection. Now, but if you're in academia, if you're a faculty member, if you're doing research, the example that's been offered to me is, let's say you're studying climate change, and if your research indicates something that's against the political party that's in control, you don't want somebody to be able to say, well, you know, let's just eliminate that position and we don't need that person anymore. Tenure protects faculty from having that happen to them.
Okay, and so to fast forward to what happened today, the full Board of Regents in Milwaukee met. What happened at that meeting?
Well, the Regents knew that they were going to have to at least consider adopting their own policy on tenure, because as of July 1st, if the GOP plan approved by the Joint Finance Committee goes through the full legislature as is, tenure will no longer exist in Wisconsin. So the Regents created this bridge policy that will allow them to have something in place July 1st, but at the same time, they created a committee, a task force, that will include faculty members to review tenure policy and decide what really needs to be in that. Now, it's important to note that nothing they put in this policy could supersede state law, and that's where the rub is in all of this, because lawmakers added language within the state law, that's under consideration, that would make it easier to terminate or lay off faculty in the case of, like, a budget issue or program reduction or program change.
So what is the significance of the vote that happened today as regards what happens next?
Well, the vote was unanimous to create a board policy and to move it from where it is now in state law to the board policy if it disappears as of July 1st. But the undercurrent that existed both yesterday during a committee meeting and today was Regent Mark Bradley wanted to send a message to the legislature to ask them not to put anything non-fiscal in the budget. In other words, take tenure, layoff language, shared governance language that reduced the role of shared governance potentially, take that out of the budget and not have it be considered. But that motion did not pass, and basically all that the Regents approved today was the new policy for tenure within Regents policy.
Now, in terms of why the Joint Finance Committee and Governor Walker, in his original proposal, wanted to strike this tenure protection language, what is the argument for making that change?
Well, I think the governor has said that he wants the University of Wisconsin system and chancellors in particular to have more flexibility over hiring, firing. They currently have plenty of latitude for hiring, but in terms of reducing the size of the workforce, which apparently is already in the works, there are buyouts on the table, and there will be layoffs as a result of some changes that have to be made, both because of the budget and also some reform efforts that are underway to make the UW system more efficient. So it's just a matter of, for lawmakers, giving the UW system more control over how they do business and not having other factors be the determining factors.
We're talking with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's reporter Karen Herzog about the UW Board of Regents' decision not to urge lawmakers to reconsider removing UW tenure from state law. They're adopting policies looking at a new proposal in April there. And has the university said that it's interested? Leadership said they're interested in gaining that kind of flexibility to hire and to fire.
They are. The big question, though, is whether they expected the language. It's quite extensive. The language about the layoff procedures. I think they expected that there was a chance that tenure could be removed from state law. And many people will tell you that it doesn't have to be enshrined in state law to be effective. In fact, most states have their tenure policies within their governing board, or like regents in our case. So that in and of itself was not the critical issue. The critical issue really is what was added to the state law regarding shared governance and layoff procedures that, again, would allow faculty, tenured faculty, that is, and indefinite-term academic staff to be dismissed in the case of a budget problem or a change in programs, academic programs.
Now, would a new policy about tenure adopted by the regents, as they're doing now, have the same weight if it's in university policy instead of state law?
Technically, it would, except that there's this state statute, and the state statute really governs how things work. So if there's something in the region's policy that would conflict with the state statute would be what would be in place that would actually have the jurisdiction. So the regents are somewhat limited by any language that is in the state statute, because in the case of the layoff rules, layoff rules are pretty firm in statute. Now, I think the regents are hopeful that the UW system can have some latitude in terms of defining the circumstances under which those things could be used to force a layoff.
Now, how would this new tenure policy at the UW, as we know it now, stack up against other university systems at comparable universities?
Well, Wisconsin is known for having both strong shared governance that gives faculty, students, and staff a real voice and some decision-making authority. And as far as tenure goes, there's a pretty standard policy for tenure. That's something that's fairly uniform within state university systems and also private schools. So it would probably be similar to other states. But generally speaking, Wisconsin is considered to be very strong in terms of protecting academic freedom and involving faculty, students, and staff in governing decisions.
Now, Wisconsin is one of the only states with tenure protections in state law, at least it has been until now. So how big a change is this for Wisconsin if you look at it in a national context?
It's hard to say in practice how big of a change it would be. Again, if there hadn't been the extra language added to state law, the GOP motion. It has not been approved as law. But the GOP motion that's expected to probably make it through the full legislature, generally intact, that does add additional language. Tenure in and of itself is one thing, but when you talk about laying off faculty, tenured faculty, for reasons other than what currently would be the circumstances of just cause, disciplinary matters, or a campus-wide financial emergency, those are pretty high standards to meet in terms of laying off faculty. Now, if you say it's a budget decision or a program-related decision, it's much easier to justify that, some would say.
Now, some have expressed concern that this will make it harder for the university to attract and retain talent, and that other competitive universities could swoop in, poach faculty here. What's the evidence for that?
Well, already one could argue that that is happening. Now, it's very clear that this has drawn a lot of national attention. Higher education sites like Inside Higher Ed, the Chronicle of Higher Education, things that really high-profile faculty and researchers would be very much in tune with, have been reporting on this whole issue. And any time you get the sense that tenure could not be ironclad, that there could be concerns about will my research and possibility get me in trouble, or could I lose my job because of what I say or do, I think that does give people cause to pause when they're considering a job offer.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Karen Herzog, higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the UW Board of Regents' decision not to urge lawmakers to reconsider removing UW tenure from state law. They voted to develop their own tenure policies moving forward. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
First, a look at what could be the next big battle for the labor movement. Strikes aimed at raising the minimum wage have been in the news recently, with a number of companies and cities opting to raise wages. Now there are new movements popping up around the country to give employees more say in their work schedules.
Groups are fighting for regulations that would prevent last-minute schedule changes, provide pay for on-call hours, accommodate health care needs of employees, among other measures.
Lydia DePillis is a reporter for The Washington Post. She joins us now to give more details. Lydia, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, to start out with, what issues are people raising when it comes to current scheduling practices?
So this occurs mostly in the low-wage retail and restaurant sectors, and although all over community transportation or parking. And what we're seeing is that employers want to match the demand that they have for services with the labor that they pay for. And they have a lot of complex computer programs that have allowed them to do this over the years. And so what that means is they'll ask a worker to come in maybe for 4 hours today and 3 hours tomorrow, or they'll change it at the last minute according to what they're finding foot traffic might be like, or the number of people who come through a restaurant.
Now, it used to be that schedules were more dependable in terms of you knew when you were going to work, and it was for a big block of time in these industries. What's changed over the years?
So I think it's that retailers have gotten smarter about how to more efficiently match the time that they have workers come in for with the times that the stores are most busy. And they've also figured out how to communicate that at the last minute to workers. And at the same time, we've had the labor market get really loose through the recession, in that people are looking for jobs, and they sometimes can't walk away if an employer makes it difficult by carving up their workday into little pieces.
So what is the effect on the workers? There have been a lot of pieces recently in the media telling people's personal stories. What have they said about how it affects their life?
So when you think about your workday, if you don't know how to plan on Sunday where you're going to be and what you're going to do on Wednesday or Friday, that makes it very difficult to arrange childcare or figure out when to take vacations. And if you have to keep open large chunks of hours in case your employer calls you up, and because you need the money, you need to work, then you can't carry out other functions that you of your life, even if that means advancing yourself, like by going to school on the side or holding down another job. So it's really very disruptive, even more so than the pay itself, which tends to be fairly low.
And so there are a handful of states, maybe more than that, who are seeking to advance laws that give some protections to people around these scheduling issues. What sorts of measures do proponents of these kinds of laws want to see?
So there's a few things that advocates are seeking. The biggest one is probably asking employers to give workers several weeks notice of the schedule that they're going to have, and punishing them if they change it. So that just gives people a little bit more stability. Another is that they feel that workers need more hours overall. There's still a lot of what's called involuntary part-time workers in the economy, and they, you can be paid $20 an hour, but it doesn't matter if you only get 10 hours a week. There are, you know, some bills have provisions to charge employers for the amount of time that they ask workers to be on call for, for them to pay for an entire shift, even if they send people home early. So those are meant to discourage employers from screwing with schedules too much.
We're talking right now with Washington Post reporter Lydia DePillis, talking about new legislation in several states around the country, including Indiana and Michigan, aimed at giving workers more control over their schedules. And Lydia, you were just talking about some of the measures that proponents of these laws are looking for. How do they make sure that these laws get enforced?
Well, it's going to be really, really difficult. The only jurisdiction that's passed one of these comprehensive ordinances so far is San Francisco, which tends to be on the leading edge of labor law protections. And they tried to make sure that the city also added a ton of money for inspectors and people to just make answer complaints and make sure that people even know that they have these rights, because they're pretty obscure. And we don't really know how that's going yet because it's very new. But you know, the thing is that a lot of these provisions are already in union contracts if you happen to be in a union. And there's a built-in enforcement mechanism in the form of shop stewards who are paid for with union dues. And there's a ton more shop stewards in a union workplace than there are inspectors in a city, generally speaking. So that's one way to handle it, but not everybody is fortunate enough to be in a union.
Now, I mentioned Indiana, Michigan. Where else is this legislation being considered? Wisconsin, as I know, as far as I know so far, isn't one of these states.
Sure. So at the moment, there are state bills in play in Indiana, as you mentioned. Maryland, one came up, it didn't pass. Massachusetts, Illinois, Connecticut, California, New York, also Oregon, and there's a proposal in the works in Washington, D.C., and probably more that are kind of cooking. Like, there's a lot of national advocacy groups and unions who see this as a really essential way to improve worker lives. And there's also a bill in Congress that would require employers to accommodate scheduling changes that workers need unless there's a business reason to deny them. That I don't see going anywhere.
And do you see these bills facing a lot of opposition, or do they seem as though they have a pretty clear path ahead for passage?
They do face opposition because employers really like to be able to schedule their workforces as they see fit. And, you know, it's almost more disruptive for a business than, say, asking them to pay more, because it's actually has to do with business practices. It's not just a line item on a budget. So, which is not to say that fair scheduling, as the term coined by those in favor of it, is bad for businesses. There are a bunch of them that are looking at how to help employees get the time stability that they need while also filling out the schedules that they have. And, you know, Walmart's done that. Gap is looking how to do that. So it's something that can be a win-win for both.
Is there any indication that states who are considering some of this legislation, who maybe have one, looking at San Francisco and California, any evidence that this would discourage businesses from moving into the area?
I don't think there's any evidence of that. I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into a business's decision to locate in a place, and mostly that has to do with the fundamentals of, do people want your product? How much does labor cost? How much does real estate cost? So it's not one of those things that would deter businesses, I think, from setting up shop.
Now, you mentioned some companies going ahead, taking changes in hand already. Whole Foods, Walmart have made some changes in their scheduling practices ahead of any sort of legislation. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a lot of times it's by request of employees. I mean, one of the biggest problems and expenses that businesses face is turnover. And so if you have a worker who you know, likes working where they are. They can deal with the wage, but they're being told at the last minute all the time when they're going to come in, and that's too disruptive for the rest of their life. They're going to quit. And you have to train a whole new person. So businesses that are moving forward in this area of HR are trying to pay for it through lowering those turnover costs, which involve retraining people and recruiting and onboarding. That all that takes time and money.
And before we let you go, is this another option, an alternative to legislation, letting companies take the changes in hand themselves?
Well, both people consulting on those changes and people pushing for the new laws say that they have to be complementary. And the laws are a nudge, but at the same time, you want to be making the business case for it, because otherwise it might just be confined to those high-profile companies that are subject to brand pressure from the outside. You know, there's a lot of companies that don't really, they're not customer-facing, so if they have a bad reputation for having unpredictable schedules, then it doesn't really matter.
Lydia, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem.
That was Washington Post reporter Lydia DePillis talking about a surge of legislation aimed at giving workers more control over their schedules.
I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The first local produce of the year is always a treat, and one of the most popular and delicious is asparagus.
Today on Food Friday, we'll get some great ideas for preparing asparagus from Johnny Hunter. He's the culinary director for Underground Food Collective in Madison. He was one of two semifinalists for this year's James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest.
And we want to hear from you. What is your favorite asparagus recipe? What dishes do you think it really makes the most of it? What shines when you use asparagus? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Johnny Hunter, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So I love asparagus now. I was a late convert, though. Wasn't part of my childhood. Have you always been a fan of asparagus, Johnny?
No, I think it much more became something that I ate as I started eating seasonally more often.
What do you like about it when you cook with it? What's special about asparagus?
I think the unique flavor. I was thinking about this the other day, and there's some bitterness in there, and there's the sweetness, and then there's kind of that vegetableness, but it tastes absolutely different than any other vegetable, I think, that you eat during the year. And I think it's awesome because it's the first one that you really have access during the spring, and so those are really kind of cool features of it.
Now, I'll eat asparagus year-round. I'll get the stuff from out of state or out of hemisphere even if I can, but it is special when it's local. How much of a difference is there between the fresh local stuff and, you know, the stuff we can buy in December?
I mean, I think the less that the asparagus has to travel, the more the flavor is going to come through. So, you know, you're going to have, it's going to kind of be a little bit more wrinkly, and it's going to lose a lot of water, and some of that crispness is gone, I think, flavor-wise. You're losing the sweet notes. So I do think that it's a significant benefit to have it, you know, in season.
So we are in the asparagus season now, right? I think I've seen it at farmer's market.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We're going into, like, I think I've had more asparagus than I can consume.
Right. Eat your weight in asparagus.
Yeah.
So how long does the season typically go?
Normally, you're looking at that first week of May. You know, it changes. It's a perennial vegetable, so it's dependent on whether or not on when it's put in the ground. So I generally see asparagus that first week of May, and then you will see it into June, maybe mid-June for sure, and then tapering off at the end of June.
Now, a controversy that I heard about, I hadn't known about, when I make asparagus, I always cut off the tough end, right? I cut off the tough end with a knife. There are partisans who say, put the knife away, break it off. Does that really make a difference?
I think you get more use if you break it off because it is the woodiness, the woody ends, it's kind of hard to chew on. If you snap it off, then it's coming off exactly where you want it to come off, the part that you can't kind of eat with your teeth.
Yeah, I was, well, this was something I picked up from the Food Channel, actually, a while ago. Rachel Ray, I'll credit her. She said that if you just bend your asparagus, it will break at the natural spot where the edible stuff stays and the other stuff goes. Is that the way you can do it?
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's just kind of like you, it's like a lever, and you hold the one side and hold the other, and then just start bending, and it will pop off really quickly.
I find it strangely satisfying to just take the whole bunch and cut it all at once.
Yeah, but then you have the chance of getting some really woody parts in there if you don't
yeah.
have the right spot.
Oh, and I do. We're talking to Johnny Hunter with the Underground Food Collective in Madison, talking about asparagus, how to cook it, what to do with it, and let's start getting into that, Johnny. I just throw it in a cast iron skillet, a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. I don't get creative with it. What are some of your favorite ways to prepare that asparagus?
I actually, the same way is, you know, the most direct way that I have it is just roasted asparagus, and, you know, we'll eat it warm or hot, but I don't overvex kind of my thinking with asparagus because we're coming out of a winter months where you have to be creative with everything to make it taste fresh.
And yay, carrots again.
We have this vegetable that is super fresh, and we have access to it in abundance, and normally I just want to eat it. A lot of times I'm just like, for the first few weeks, I just eat it raw. But I like roasting it, and I think that's a really simple preparation. You don't have to overthink it. But I have some other ideas maybe to help people at this point of the year when they're like, okay, what else do I do with asparagus in my CSA box that keeps coming full of it? So
yeah, and we want to hear those for sure. But first of all, what is your technique for roasting asparagus? And does that take like a little bit of the bitterness out of it?
Definitely, and it promotes that roasted flavor, and you get the caramelization, which is delicious. So what I do is, and I think you're right about using a cast iron. I think it's a great vehicle for it because it heats everything up. It holds like a constant temperature if you heat it up nicely instead of something like a aluminum pan that might, you know, kind of lose temperature quickly. You don't get as even browning. But for me, it's really nice to have that layer of brown on one side of it that is crispy and kind of delicious. So, you know, 400 degrees, 15 minutes, toss it with olive oil, some salt and pepper, and maybe a squeeze of lemon when it's done.
That's what I like. It's kind of hard to screw up when you just roast the asparagus, either in the oven or I do it on the stovetop, too. We'll get into some more complicated recipes, still pretty easy, actually, in just a few. First, we've got Jill on the line in Rhinelander. You can join in, too, with your asparagus tips. Your tips on how to cook asparagus at 800-642-1234. Jill, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say those, quote, woody stems of the asparagus that you, quote, can't eat, if you peel them, they are delicious raw. You have little asparagus sticks.
Okay, yep. So how, you just peel them with a knife or by hand?
You would just take a knife and that tough skin will peel off, or you can use one of those vegetable peelers. The same thing with the, quote, tough stalks of broccoli. You can peel off that tough outside hide and cut them up into sticks, and they're delicious raw.
Well, I never knew that, Jill. Thanks a lot for the call. So we can make use of that part of the asparagus that I didn't think we could use, Johnny.
Yeah, actually, and that is a really good point. You can definitely peel it and leave it on there, and then when you roast it and stuff, you just have the end peeled off about the last inch and a half or so. The other thing that, you know, and one of the main reasons that we actually do knock off the ends is because we use it to make a broth or a soup. So you can add asparagus flavor into, you know, into a soup, or if you want to make like a vegetable broth. So it can be, it should never be wasted.
And you've got a couple of recipes for us to think about. What are some things if we want to get more adventurous with our asparagus at this point in the season?
Sure. So the recipes. Okay. So the recipe that I sent that I was talking about, and I want to I think it's funny because I think I remember hearing Tori Miller give a very similar recipe about 10 years ago on Wisconsin Public Radio, and I've messed around with it a lot since then, but it's funny because we're good friends, and I always think back to hearing him talk about asparagus back then. But so one of my favorites is just doing a blanched asparagus salad with a shallot vinaigrette. I like the red wine vinegar and some mustard. So you just blanch it for 4 or 5 minutes in a boiling water, and then pull it out and toss it with the shallot vinaigrette, and then throw some hard-boiled egg and some Parmesan cheese on it.
That sounds really good and pretty simple, I think.
Very simple.
Yeah, we've got that and some other asparagus recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, I've been hesitant to put asparagus in boiling water because I think of overcooked, mushified asparagus. But that's the key, just 3 to 5 minutes, you said.
Yeah, really, really edge on the side of not overcooking. Because I think you're right. Everyone's had like a terrible experience with overcooked asparagus. Another recipe that I didn't put up there, but I thought maybe people would enjoy trying to do this, is kind of frying it, so doing like a batter and then dredging it in either breadcrumbs or flour, and then frying it in olive oil on a stovetop until it browns up. You know, you get a kind of a different texture from the outside of it and still have that kind of soft, delicious asparagus.
And how much oil are we talking here? Are we just sautéing this, or are we, like, deep frying it with, you know, actual...
Fried Eddie style.
Right, yeah.
I think you can do either. You know, if you're really ambitious and you want to do, like, a tower of them, then maybe go with the oil, with the large batter, but you could pan fry it pretty easily.
Oh, that sounds yummy, too.
Yeah, hard to go wrong with batter fried any vegetable, yeah.
Yeah, then you sort of can tell yourself you're eating a health food. Okay, let's go to Lisa joining us in Kadan. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I just have a question. So if you have a patch of asparagus in your yard, or you see it in the ditch in the road, the country road next to you, does it matter to have it continue to grow back better if you cut it below the ground with a knife, or if you break it off at that point with your hand?
Yeah, great question, Lisa. Thanks. So what about the foraging part, Johnny?
Okay, so I don't grow asparagus personally, but when I talk to the farmers who grow it, they definitely say that cutting it is the way to do it instead of breaking it off. So, and kind of cutting it lower. But this is not expert advice at all here. So,
all right, we'll get more of the cooking side of asparagus coming up. We are talking to Johnny Hunter. He's with the Underground Food Collective. He's giving us advice on cooking with that seasonal vegetable, one of my favorites, asparagus. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite recipe that uses asparagus? Have you always loved it, or did it take you a while to develop a taste? Do you have a recipe to share? You can call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about asparagus now on Food Friday, and we're happy to have Johnny Hunter with us. He's the culinary director for the Underground Food Collective in Madison and was one of two semifinalists for this year's James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest.
And we want to hear from you. How do you use asparagus? Do you have a unique recipe to share? Do you look forward to asparagus season every year at this time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Ann joining us in Pewaukee. Ann, hi.
Hi, guys. Hi, Johnny. I have a recipe that's an old farm recipe. I grew up with it here in Wisconsin. I'm from Pewaukee. And did you ever hear of goldenrod?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. And I'm not going to tell you anything new. It's where you have English muffin or toast, and then you steam the asparagus and put it on the muffin, and then you make a roux gravy, white gravy, and put the egg whites in it, and a hard-boiled egg. You put the egg whites in, and then you chop up the golden yellow insides and sprinkle it over, and salt and pepper, and it's just delicious.
Wow. Oh, and that's called goldenrod?
It's called goldenrod, and I want some now.
And that sounds really good.
I do, too.
That sounds delicious. I was thinking of the edible wildflower.
Oh,
I was, too. That's why it took my brain a minute to reroute, but that sounded delicious. Thank you.
That's a great recipe. I think it speaks to my favorite asparagus kind of combination, which is egg and asparagus.
Yeah, we were talking off mic about how good asparagus is in quiche. It's another egg and asparagus combination.
Yeah, I think that, or even if you don't want to have to do a quiche, just a frittata is a really easy recipe for people to do, and it's quick, and you don't have to make a crust, and it just goes so well together.
Or even if I have leftover asparagus, which doesn't happen often, usually gets eaten, but when I do, just throwing in the pan, frying up eggs with it, scrambled eggs around the leftover asparagus, eggs and asparagus seem like a natural combo.
Yeah, I think it's the richness playing off the kind of the high notes and the bitterness and the kind of vegetable flavor from the asparagus that works so well.
And if you want to add some kind of cheese to it, say to your frittata or your quiche, what do you think goes well with that asparagus taste?
Definitely, I like the creamier cheeses. So, you can do anything from a cheddar, or I really like it with the Pleasant Ridge Reserve from Uplands Dairy. I think it goes nicely with asparagus. It's kind of fruity and creamy flavor. Also, I gave a recipe where I used kind of a soft rind cheese or a brie with shaved asparagus and a vinaigrette, which I think is a really nice, and some torn bread. So,
all right, back to our callers now. We've got Eric on the line in Green Bay. Eric, hi.
Hi. I usually take asparagus, throw it on the grill, and grill it in some olive oil, sprinkle olive oil all over it, and then throw it on, toss it around a little bit, and that's a great way. Otherwise, you take the same thing, but you wrap the pieces in prosciutto and then put some Parmesan cheese on top of it. Ooh. So you wrap a couple pieces in prosciutto and then Parmesan on top.
It's great. Like, and then you throw that all on the grill with the prosciutto and everything, Eric.
Oh, it's like heaven.
Great, Eric. Thanks a lot. So a couple things there. First of all, Johnny, wrapping your asparagus in pork product. I know people do bacon sometimes. He's talking prosciutto there.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very nice combination, the ham and the kind of the dry-aged prosciutto there is just, it's wonderful. I actually prefer it to bacon. And then I like his idea of grilling, too. And one thing he talked about was just kind of how he grills it straight. He doesn't worry about blanching it. I think that's a good idea, and I know a lot of people do blanch asparagus before they grill, but I would say, for the most part, that it's not necessary.
Oh, that makes it easier. All right, well, thank you for that idea there. We're going to go next to Sandy in Walworth. Sandy, hi.
Hello. I have a recipe that I got from my sister. She got it from Vegetarian Times, and it's for asparagus pesto lasagna, and it is out of this world awesome.
Pesto and lasagna, so a whole lot of things going on there with the asparagus and the Italian stuff. What do you think about that combo, Johnny?
The one question I have is, do you make the pesto with the asparagus, or is it separate?
The pesto goes into the creamy sauce that you use in there.
So, but is it an asparagus pesto or a normal?
No, a regular pesto. Hmm.
So one thing you might want to think of is just making an asparagus pesto instead of making a regular pesto with basil.
So wait, how would you do that?
So you would want to blanch it in this circumstance, but you could just take the asparagus, blanch it, and then add olive oil, some lemon, asparagus, and some kind of nut. Pine nuts or walnuts are used. A lot of times when I'm making pestos, though, I use pumpkin seeds because of nut allergies, and I think the pumpkin seeds have a nice flavor. And then blend it all together, and you have a dip, or, if you wanted a super asparagus lasagna pesto, it's going to have lots of extra asparagus flavor in there.
And Sandy, just checking on how you make this asparagus lasagna, I assume you just layer it in where you'd layer in meat or mushrooms or something like that. Do you cook the asparagus at all before it goes in?
Well, you cut it into little bits and you saute it with some garlic.
Okay.
And
so
then you have your sauce and you have your cheese and you have your layers of lasagna pasta.
So it's pre-sauteed, and then it goes in with the layers. And that's, I think, a key a lot of times to veggie lasagnas. You want something with that texture to replace the texture of the meat. And a lot of times people do with
mushrooms
or eggplants, I think I've seen.
Like yeah. Well,
asparagus, great plant.
Spring idea there. Well, thank you for that, Sandy. And let's go next to Pat in Duluth. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I've been making an asparagus soup for years, and this year I started adding some stinging nettle to it at the very, very end of the cooking, and then I just puree it all together, and that stinging nettle has brought it to an entirely new level. We just love it.
I got to ask, what does stinging nettle taste like? I know people eat it, and they drink it as tea. I just can't get past that. It stings me, so
and
I want to eat
soup,
it.
Yes. Well, tell us, Pat.
Well, if you if you get it when it's very young, it's just like spinach, even milder than spinach.
Huh.
And I've been using it even when it's so high as like 6 inches. But I will say that it's used by a lot of our butterflies, especially those that overwinter. And so you don't want to get any, you don't want to take nettle that they have laid their eggs on.
Okay, well, that is interesting.
I also am a huge proponent of cooking with nettles. Again, it's one of those things that's available early, and it's one of the first chances you get to eat something. And I think it has a nice flavor. Again, it's very vegetable-flavored. But making a tea with it is delicious. We use it all the time in the spring ingredients. It's really nice.
I got it in my CSA box once, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to try it. But you did have to wear the gloves, even though I guess it was early on in the season, and I just couldn't get past the stinging nettle part, even though it tasted delicious. I don't know.
Yeah, you do want to wear gloves when you're handling it. But if once you do a blanch with it normally in most cooking preparations, and so that will take care of any of the stinging properties, or any type of cooking will take care of that, but most people blanch it before they use it.
Johnny, as we wrap up, as you said, we're in the midst of asparagus season. Do you ever get to a point this time of year where you're like, okay, too much asparagus, I'm done with it, I can't face it anymore?
Yeah, I think we go so big in on asparagus, you know, we try to put it in everywhere that by the time it's gone, I'm okay with it.
You're ready to be done.
Yeah, but I only eat asparagus when it's in season. And there's a couple things I do that with, and I think that asparagus is one of the things that I think is really worthwhile.
All right, Johnny, thank you so much for joining us for Food Friday.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's Johnny Hunter. He's the culinary director for Underground Food Collective in Madison. He was one of two semifinalists for this year's James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest.
And don't forget, you can find a handful of Johnny's delicious asparagus recipes over on the Central Time Facebook page. And if you've got other advice, mm-hmm. recipes, tips for listeners who want to try some of yours, you could leave them there too.
Yeah, I need to get some more asparagus. I've eaten a lot. I'm ready to eat some more right now-ish, actually.
Today is a very special day, if you hadn't heard. Kind of a high holiday, at least for Rob. Mm-hmm. This Friday, June 5th, is National Donut Day. Not to be confused with National Donut Day, which is spelled D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T. That one is in November, and that's got a different backstory.
So this June National Donut Day, that's D-O-N-U-T, the shorter spelling, it was organized in 1938 by the Salvation Army over in Chicago to honor the women known as Donut Lassies. Now, the story is they gave treats to soldiers on the front lines during World War I, so we're talking 100 years ago.
So today's National Donut Day has some cool historical underpinnings you can know about. The one in November, more about just donuts are yummy. Of course, donuts are yummy all the time. Some places are even giving away a free donut today if you're feeling highly motivated.
How many donuts have I eaten today?
I'm sad to say zero.
Zero.
There weren't any.
Yeah, you'd think. I mean, people bring in donuts at WPR for their birthday or their first day on the job, their last day on the job, or Friday the 13th. One of our IT people brings in donuts
right,
every Friday the 13th.
Or because there's oxygen in the atmosphere or because
right.
they woke up in the morning.
Mercury's in retrograde, whatever. Today, nobody brought. I was going to get them, but I thought, oh, we're going to be awash in donuts on Donut Day. No, but maybe after work, I'll find the time and inclination to celebrate.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.